So before I'm going in the smoking lounge, Steve, I'm going to go into one of those breastfeeding cubicles that they have.
Have you been in a breastfeeding cubicle?
I have not been in it, but I've seriously thought about it from time to time, like late at night, you know, you're there, you're waiting, you know, your flight's delayed or, you know, and it's no point in going to a hotel room. I'm like going, I wonder if I just go in that breastfeeding cubicle, if I could just like lock the door and lay down. I mean, who's, you know, nobody going to be breastfeeding in the middle of the night, right? Like, but then I'm like, can you get arrested for that? Okay.
Probably.
I'm off on a whole nother tangent, but.
Yeah, well, that's what happens with side shtick. Here we are. I'm Steve Giordano.
I'm Bob Allen.
And this is Cockpit Casual, the podcast, week 3, episode 3. We did it. We're on for the third week. It was tight.
I know. Yeah, this one, I wasn't sure we were going to be able to get it done. We've had the last week has been busy.
It really has. The last, really, pretty much the last 2 weeks, like the last 12 days, it was one of those things where we were like, well, we have a lot of free time right now. Let's start a podcast. And that opened up the floodgates.
That's all we had to do is like, you know, have something to do. And then everybody starts calling and we start moving airplanes again. You know,
no doubt.
Always feast or famine in this business. We've talked about it before, but it really is.
It really is. And this week has been crazy. So let's talk about kind of what happened this week. So obviously in the world, lots has been going on. And quite frankly, I've been on the move so much that I haven't really gotten to, I mean, I've been kind of watching social media. I mean, I don't really watch the news. But I've been, you know, listening to the podcasts that I listen to about world events and stuff like that. So I'm kind of up to speed. One thing I noticed is our predictions on the routings, like, man, we were dead on.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. I mean, that's where they still are to this day. I was looking at Flight Radar 24 and sure enough, they're on the exact routes that we talked about in last episode.
Yeah, the two big voids that exist, it's almost like it almost looks like two bubbles, the Ukraine bubble, the Ukraine-Russia bubble, and then the Middle East-Persian Gulf bubble. Aircraft are, just like we said, they're transiting north over the stands, they're transiting south over the middle of Saudi Arabia and Oman. It's worked. We actually have gotten a couple of calls from some clients, possibly thinking about moving some airplanes out of the region, or at least coming up with a contingency plan to move aircraft out of the region. So that's really led to us having to do a little bit of planning, a little bit of research. Right now, most of the airports are still either closed or at very, very low capacity.
Yeah, I see Emirates operating pretty heavily out of Dubai, but you don't see Qatar really at all. It's really Dubai Airport is the main place. I know Tel Aviv closed off all traffic to any private aircraft.
Yeah, that's another thing. The airlines are one thing. One of the first things that usually goes are kind of the private ops, unless they're sanctioned directly by a government or, you know, military or something like that. You know, we're like the lowest priority, really. When things go and there's limited slots, they want to get passengers and cargo moving, not airplanes transiting. So, you know, we've had some inquiries. I think we had an inquiry about Abu Dhabi. Right now, our current plan is if something does come up, we'd have to probably fly into Muscat and then go via car.
Well, that's the problem, is getting crews on site
is
a big issue. It's not only flying the airplane out, but getting the crew there. And I was just reading where Muscat, I think there was an 8-hour border crossing into UAE right now, or vice
like
versa. I don't know. Yeah, land the land border if you take a car.
Yeah.
So,
and it's, I think it's what, a 4-hour drive or maybe 5. I don't know. I've never made the drive, but it is drivable, Muscat to Abu Dhabi, Dubai. I mean, I guess if we have to do it, that's the way. Nobody's pulled the trigger on that.
Yeah, we've always found a way to make stuff happen. And I mean, somebody's paying us to get an airplane out. We're going to make it happen.
Definitely. So high fuel prices have been kind of a hot topic this week. And really, that is the largest variable of airline health or sickness. When the fuel price hits that $100 a barrel mark, people start to go into panic mode. And, you know, we've seen a ton of volatility this week. I'm not like a commodities expert. I don't I'm not an investment guy. You're more of that guy. But I mean, obviously, I keep an eye on the stock market at large and the price of oil. I know that it topped around 110 at one point briefly. We live in this high news, high cycle, volatile environment. And it seems like even fuel prices have just been moving like on that.
Oh, it's been crazy.
Fire.
Yeah. Crazy. I mean, it spiked up, then it dropped down. I think it was below 80 at one point. I think it's back up today. With Nomadic, our fuel prices update every Tuesday. So we have to check on Tuesdays what the week's price is. And so, like, I've had to go back and revise quotes to customers as the fuel went up, you know, a dollar a gallon in a lot of places.
Let's talk about that real quick. The way that we get fuel, we don't just call the FBO and find out what their rate is. We have credit lines with multiple fuel suppliers worldwide. So I think we have like four. I know we had five at one point. I think we're really using four main fuel suppliers at this point. AEG, Titan, JetX, World. There are some others as well that we've used a few times. But for the most part, the reason we do that is because they give us a lot of credit. I mean, we have, you know, like $1 million of credit at some of these suppliers. And of course, the terms are net 7, net 15 terms or whatever, but we get good pricing based on the volume that we take annually as far as fuel purchasing. And, you know, I mean, this week alone, we bought 35, 40,000 gallons of fuel. I mean, we buy a lot of gas.
Yeah. Like millions of gallons a year.
Yeah. And so that's why we get, you know, really good pricing and better than the airlines in some cases, certainly better than what's immediately available to anybody else who's just buying fuel. So I want to say that I think we took about 10 or 12,000 gallons out of Phoenix. We were still at sub 4. I think we were at 350 in Phoenix.
Yeah, I think so.
Lines.
So
360.
Yeah, so it was still that Tuesday's pricing, and that last week's pricing hadn't gone up at all.
Right.
But this past Tuesday, 2 days ago, it skyrocketed. I mean, it went up a dollar a gallon in most places.
Yeah. And for us, I mean, obviously that affects our clients. It affects how much money we have to float, you know, from the time we operate a trip to the time our payment terms, you know, deliver payment to our bank accounts. But at the end of the day, the price of fuel is passed along to the client. So the airplane has to move and they're going to pay, whether it's $2 a gallon or $8 a gallon. It's going to, you know, that fuel is going to be purchased and we're going to go. So it's not like high price of fuel is really going to negatively affect us other than the amount of cash that we have to float on each trip. And if we have a lot of trips, I mean, that could be $750,000 in a 2 week period.
Yeah. Although it's still not fun revising a quote that you gave a customer, and now it's like $10,000 or $15,000 more. Regardless, they don't like it.
We have to contractually ensure, I think I've said this on one of the other pods, ensure that we have the variable costs like fuel and travel. You know, there's a disclaimer in there so that we can adjust that, and so we don't totally screw ourselves. Fuel prices going up don't really affect us negatively. In fact, they could affect us positively in some ways. And, you know, I don't necessarily cheer on the destruction of our industry that we support, but busy is good. And
yeah, it creates a lot of volatility.
It does.
Yeah.
So what are the things that we can expect to see with fuel above $100 a barrel? Well, airlines reducing capacity always is underlying trigger for why we start moving airplanes, whether that means early lease returns, aircraft going into storage. When an airline cuts capacity, the airplanes have to go somewhere. They can't just sit and rot away or they lose value. They have to either go into storage or get returned to the lessor. And that's, you know, something that is going to cause us to ferry an airplane.
Well, and historically, that volatility of the industry, whether it's you know, things are going downhill economically or uphill economically, that's when we do our best. That's when the most aircraft transitions happen.
Exactly. So it's not one of those things where, oil hit 110, all of a sudden people start parking aircraft. It happens over time. So this volatile market it creates a lot of uncertainty, of course. And I'm sure all the bean counters at all the airlines and all the lessors are watching very closely to try to stay ahead of things. You know, whether it means if there is going to be a push, if there's sustained pricing above 100, 110, God forbid, 115, 20, 25, 30. I mean, things start getting ugly fast. And the first thing that happens are the least fuel efficient aircraft end up getting parked first. And it's interesting, right? Because there's been a second wind for A320 COs and 737 NGs, 800s, yeah. 900s primarily. And the value of those aircraft has sharply risen, you know, a couple of years ago. And it's been like artificially high, I would say, because of the slow deliveries of the MAX and the NEOs.
Yeah, the engine problems with the NEOs have definitely affected that.
And so a 737-800, which may have been worth $25, $28, $30 million over the last couple of years, maybe it really should have been at 15, or historically would have been at 15 or 17 or even 12 for the older models. They've been in demand just because there has been a need for capacity. And all of a sudden, now with fuel possibly being crunched, those aircraft are less and less attractive to both the airlines and the lessors, because they're significantly less efficient fuel-wise. So a 737-800 versus a 737 MAX 8, I think the number is like close to 20%, right?
Yeah.
On efficiency?
Yeah, that's what they say. That's so, probably about right. You know, when we ferry them, I mean, you can see where the operating costs would be about 20% less.
It's hard for us to firsthand see that. We always operate empty, right? Like an empty airplane behaves a lot differently performance-wise than an airplane that's filled with passengers and or bags, cargo. So we don't necessarily see it, but you know, they say 20, 25% savings with NEO versus CO, MAX versus NG. And so what happens? All those older aircraft, the previous generation aircraft that are less efficient, become less valuable. And so the airlines want to fly more fuel efficient aircraft. So they will prioritize those aircraft remaining on the line, and they'd be looking to park the NGs, the COs, and even like the 75, 76s. There's still airlines, you know, United still runs them, Delta still runs them. You start seeing those aircraft, which are very major gas guzzlers, consider going out of service or temporarily going into storage or something like that. So the airlines will look to go more efficient on the aircraft side. And then the lessors now have these less efficient, less desirable aircraft on their books. And, you know, they're always looking at share value, you know, looking out for the interest of the shareholders. And that could mean divesting from the lower valued assets, you know, while they still have some value, right? So that's the question: when to divest, right? So,
yeah, exactly.
Those are all the reasons that we could be busier on account of higher price fuel. We'll see what happens.
Yep, all depends on how long all this stuff lasts in the Middle East, I guess, before it's resolved in some way.
Let's hope it's going to be resolved. So over this last, let's call it week and a half, it's been crazy. I've been running around like a madman. You've had a much easier go at it, haven't you?
Yeah, I've had a much more sane week than you have, I think.
It started Monday of last week, right?
Yeah. Although I'm just getting my voice back. I've done a lot of talking this week.
And not on the pod.
No, exactly.
So, let's go back. It's currently Thursday, March 12th, at the time of recording. So we're talking Monday, March, whatever that was.
I guess so. Since then, I mean, I've done a 757 demo flight.
March 2nd.
Yeah. I don't know what day that was or date. I can't keep track of them anymore. I never could, actually.
Yeah, that was Monday the 2nd. You demoed the 7.5 in Phoenix.
Yeah, yeah. So I did that. Then I played chauffeur for you. I was your car driver all last week, basically. I'll let you talk about your own projects, but I was your chauffeur, and then I did a short hop in a 737.
We'll cover that too. With my mess.
Yeah, exactly.
You had to save the day.
Yeah. So then I was supposed to fly all last weekend. I was supposed to fly a ferry flight, and that got delayed. That's possibly coming up this weekend. But is what it did. It opened up my time to go to ISTAT, which is a big aviation finance conference.
We try to go there every year. Society of Transport Aircraft Traders, I believe is what it stands for.
Yeah. Or appraisers and traders or something. I've never known what it actually stands for.
We've been members of ISTAT forever. It's all it's mostly lessors and airlines. It's the people that transact the aircraft. It's not necessarily finance. It's not technical. It's like the deal guys.
Yeah. I don't know how many people there are, 1,000, 1,500, it's a lot of people to me, but I mean, if you look at the entire industry, it's a very small industry, really.
They've broken it out by regions. So like this was ISTAT Americas. There's one in the US every year that's called ISTAT Americas. I think they do a South America one, which is a smaller event now also. Then there's ISTAT Europe and there's ISTAT Asia. Those are the big ones.
Yeah. So they go kind of all year, and then there's other events that are going on, but it's all people that we do business with on a regular basis. So, it's great. I love going to them because I see all the.
This year?
It was in San Diego. So last year it was in Scottsdale. So it was like right in my backyard. So, quick hop over to San Diego, stayed a few days, was able to, shake hands and talk to a lot of our clients and get introduced to new ones. It's a networking event. At the same time, it is a good place to, have some face time with, our long-term clients. There's a lot of people that I still haven't met. I've talked to them on the phone for 20 years and sent emails back and forth. And to this day, I've still never met them.
Yeah, so it's a good opportunity to put a name and a face together.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just kind of getting to know each other. So, it's a way to go, sit down, have some drinks and dinner with old friends and tell war stories and kind of, get a feel what's coming up in the industry.
Anybody recognize Captain Bob, or were there any comments about the podcast?
Everybody has seen the Cockpit Casual and loves the podcast. I mean, I got nothing but great feedback, and everybody just said they want more. Keep it up. And it was great talking to all of you at ISTAT that did come up and say hi. The ones that did come say hi that I didn't know before, I really appreciate that you did. So it was nice to meet everybody and talk about the industry, talk about Nomadic, and talk about Cockpit Casual.
I feel like I always have to work whenever there's one of these conferences. I was going to go to MRO this year. I didn't get to that. So, I mean, fortunately, we have Wes out there representing us and keeping things alive. And I'm glad you got to go this year. My week was crazy. So I went to Greenwood, Mississippi the day after we recorded the last pod. That was Monday the 2nd. The plan was get out there, get that 737 domestic flown to Phoenix, Goodyear. And then get home. And my whole plan was 24 hours. I left in the morning on Monday. DAR met us in Memphis. We're going to drive down to Greenwood, fly the airplane out, within an hour, get to Phoenix, hop the red eye home. I was like, all right, 24 hours, no shower. I could do this. Grab Pat Lewis, drove out to the airport, flew down to Memphis. And while I'm sitting there actually ready to board, the DAR texts me, and he was flying on Spirit, and his flight got canceled to Memphis. And so he's like, I'm not even going to arrive Memphis until 5 p.m. And we were scheduled out at 1.
Man. Why did you think it was going to be any different, actually?
I don't know. I'm always optimistic, man. So, but I know how it goes. So, you know, I packed a backpack with an extra change of underwear and socks, another pair of pants and another t-shirt and another polo and all the things just in a backpack, right? Just a one bag trip just in case. Toothbrush, some toothpaste. We get down there and Pat and I needed to kill some time until, Ryan, the DAR, met us. And so what do you do in Memphis? We went to Graceland.
You went to Elvis's house?
I did. and excuse me.
Oh my God. That's awesome.
So I'm a big fan of music. I'm not like a huge Elvis guy. I like some Elvis songs. I mean, I respect his work. I mean, you know, kind of the grandfather of modern rock. So, you know, but I'm watching Paradise right now. And I don't know if you've seen the TV. It's a great show.
I know. I haven't seen it. I've been watching Landman, but it's like, you know, I'm waiting for season three now. So that's my extent of shows that I've watched.
Well, early on in Paradise, I'm not going to give you the whole thing, but basically, you know, there was a massive disaster, like end of the world type event, catastrophic. A bunch of people went into a bunker. A bunch of people didn't. One of the characters ended up was a tour guide at Graceland. And so like a whole episode takes place in a mock-up of Graceland, identical. And we were there. I'm like, let's go see. And Pat was also watching Paradise. So we had a rental car that we were supposed to drive down to Greenwood. So we went to Graceland, $85 a person. We were like the only ones there.
$85 to get in there?
Yeah. But you know what? It was so well worth it. It was cool. We walked around the mansion. There's his airplanes. There's a Convair, that Convair jet that he has.
Yeah. Is it an 880 or something?
Yeah, it's a big, it looks like a DC-8, but shorter. Somebody
here will know what it is.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be one of the fastest commercial jets ever made. I always wanted to fly one.
It's called the Lisa Marie. So you can walk through that. And then his Jetstar is there as well. We actually shockingly didn't go through the airplanes because we ran out of time. Yeah, we didn't. We just looked at them on the outside. I know.
But you can actually like go in the airplanes?
You can go in. You can go in the Convair for sure. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That would have been the first thing that I would have done.
I know. I wanted to go and we just spent too much time in the mansion itself, in Graceland itself. It's cool. You know, it's so like 60s and 70s. It's like a time capsule. I mean, shag carpeting. It's unique. If you ever get to Memphis, I'm not even an Elvis guy. I have no regrets. I'm glad I did it. I might even do it again. It was really, really cool.
I'm going to have to do that now. I'll put it on the bucket list.
So we went to Graceland and then we looked at our watches. We're like, oh man, we don't know time to the airplane. We're going to go back to the airport. We're going to pick up the DAR. And we picked him up and we drove down to Mississippi. And while we're driving down, we get a call from a client who said, the oxygen bottle's empty. We can't fly today. The oxygen bottle has to be serviced, refilled. We need a new oxygen bottle. And there's no one around. They got to drive up to Memphis to get it done.
There's no oxygen in Greenwood, Mississippi. You can't go to the gas station and, you know, hook it up.
Nope. So there was delay number one. And he said there was a couple of other ADs that had to get signed off on each of the engines. And the maintenance crew that was there working on it, they weren't real familiar with 737s. They came in from another MRO up in the Memphis area. They had the tools, but they didn't have everything they needed. They also needed to do the pitot-static check. So anyway, they sent us down there with the airplane not ready, is a long story short. And then Pat tells me they didn't bring a change of clothes.
Boom. There it is. Now I know what happened.
Exactly.
Yeah. It is totally his fault. If you don't bring clothes for an overnight, even if you think you're not going to be overnight, you're definitely going to be stuck overnight.
So regardless, it wasn't the oxygen bottle. It wasn't the other. It wasn't the pitot-static check. It was Pat not bringing a change of underwear and toiletries, which did it. And I actually came up with a new rule. Of course, it was a little too late. Like I didn't come up with it until day two. But the new rule, Bob, and keep this in mind, is if you delay a trip because you don't bring a change of clothes, then we get to pick your outfit the next day.
Absolutely. I love it. I can't wait for the next guy to not bring his clothes and we get a delay because of it.
Yeah, I hope it's you.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah, my famous last words here.
I didn't think of the new policy until we were on the airplane about to depart, but I was, man, because I would have had him in sequins, maybe a dress.
That's good.
I don't know.
In Mississippi.
In Mississippi. Yeah. So anyway, we didn't do that. He caused a delay. Got a hotel room. Went for some tacos. Next morning, showed up at the airplane, and we ended up there all day. Because you know what the rule is.
What's
the rule?
I was waiting for you.
What's the rule? The rule is planes don't move until?
Till the sun sets.
Until the sun sets.
Every time. You get there at 6 a.m., you will be there all day until that sun sets.
So finally, the sun sets. We get ready to go. Pat and I are booked on a 10 p.m. flight out of Phoenix, and or 11 or something. And we're cutting it close. We go to start engines. I go to start the APU, actually. And the APU won't start because the battery's dead. I mean, you got to be kidding me. And it wasn't, I mean, the battery was dead. The battery charger wasn't properly indicating. Long story short, an hour and a half, I was kind of out there driving the bus, man. I was out there pushing mechanics. Let's swap batteries. Anything that we could do, because if we didn't get it, I mean, they needed the airplane.
Yeah, and it had to leave. I mean, yeah, they're waiting for the airplane. The MRO is, you know, I don't know what time it was closing. You know, you would have been stuck another day or so if you didn't push to get it out. And right. By the way, this is like a normal scenario for us.
Yeah, this is just another Tuesday.
This is not unusual.
So hour and a half troubleshooting, like we, you know, I'm kind of dictating what we should try. We tried swapping the two batteries, which actually worked somehow. By swapping the batteries, it like activated a relay. The battery charger went back online and everything was fine. Like, just like there was no problem to begin with. We fired up the engines. We departed at 10 p.m. local time. And unfortunately, there was another problem. Goodyear, our destination airport, was NOTAM closed. So they still wanted us to get the airplane out. We ended up flying all the way to Phoenix. We get into Sky Harbor and you meet us there and drove us around. Pat and I managed to get home. I got home by Wednesday morning, but then that left us in a little bit of a predicament.
Yeah, because you guys were catching the red eye that night. You caught it. So then I was just going to take over and just hop the airplane over, you know, at like 6 o'clock the next morning. So it was just, it was literally going to be there 6 or 7 hours. Normally I would just grab my son, you know, throw him in the right seat. He's actually a qualified 737, pilot. But he was off on a trip. So it's 10, 11 o'clock at night. And we're like, okay, who do we know in Phoenix that can fly with me? And who's going to answer their phone at this time of night? That's the other part of it.
It was 11. We had already rebooked to the 12:35 a.m. and I back to Philly.
That's right. So we start going down our contacts in the phone. I'm going through my Kitty Hawk app. Like, I'm literally going through searching for pilots, CFIs, anybody with a multi-instrument commercial that's in the Phoenix area. I'm ready to cold call somebody out of the blue. So we actually called a pilot that's, you know, used to fly with us quite a bit, who lives in the Phoenix area. So you actually got a hold of him.
Yeah. He was in Mexico. On his boat. Yeah, I can't do it. But he goes, but my daughter is a CFI and she just got hired at a regional. She's leaving. And by the way, we don't need a type rated pilot for a U.S. domestic op in the right seat as long as one of us is current qualified. You have to have a commercial and a multi. You can sit in the seat. You can run the radios. There's no SIC requirement whatsoever for a domestic Part 91 flight. So that's all. We only needed somebody with a commercial multi to sit in the right seat. Because he says to me, he goes, you want to take my daughter? I said, man, if she's willing. And so she was super excited about it. She's leaving in a month for the regionals. I think she got her notice in already. at the flight school, and she had a blast, yeah. huh?
Oh, and she did. And she did great. You know, she'd been flying, you know, some glass cockpits and things like that. She's very familiar with, you know, jumping in that airplane. It was literally like nothing to her. She was great on the radios. You know, I mean, it was a whole lot. It was the fire, you know, the fire hose coming at her. I mean, airplane that she'd never been in, this larger, you know, much larger aircraft than she's used to. And it's a Phoenix to Goodyear. I mean, you take off, you know,
you
clean up. Yeah. Clean up and it's almost, you know, it's ready to put the gear down again. I mean, so I gave her a quick and dirty course of, you know, how to operate the flaps, the gear, go through some emergency procedures. If this happens, you know, here's this, here's the QRH. We went through all of that stuff, you know, for about an hour and, you know, but she adapted to it like it was nothing. So it was great. But I mean, that being said, this is what I tell everybody all the time. Network, network, network. You know, just get to know lots of people. If somebody would have been on Kitty Hawk in my database, I would have been calling you at 11 p.m. on...
If you're a Phoenix CFI with a multi and some skills, get on our radar because you never know.
Exactly. We move a lot of airplanes in this area, you know, in Arizona. So you never know. It's important.
So I got home on Wednesday. And then on Saturday, I came back to Phoenix with Pat again, and you picked us up at the airport and drove us down to Marana. That was Phoenix landing number 2, picked up a wide body. It's one of those trips that I can't really go into detail about due to confidentiality, but it was a wide body aircraft, but we had to fly it from Marana to Shanghai. So we get down to Marana and, the fuel's super expensive there. It's, I think, $7 a gallon or something. So, you know, it's a wide body. I mean, we're going to need 12,000 gallons worth of fuel. That adds up. We have a really good deal with Phoenix for handling. And then, you know, one of our contract suppliers gives a commercial rate out of Phoenix. So we use Phoenix to tanker. So first leg was 15 minutes, take off the touchdown, back up to Sky Harbor, my third landing at Sky Harbor in... 4 days.
Yeah.
And then you met us up there again.
I dropped you off. And then as soon as you took off, then I drove up I-10 back to Sky Harbor Airport to meet with you guys again.
Yep. And that was a planned 3-hour sit because we had a slot to make in Shanghai. In China, they're real specific about what time you have to arrive. And in order to make that slot, we had to depart at a certain time, especially because the airplane wasn't going to be able to make it with the winds nonstop from Phoenix to Shanghai. So we had to go Phoenix to Anchorage to Shanghai, fuel stop in Anchorage. It's basically a 2-leg ferry to get over there. And we accounted for an hour and a half on the ground in Anchorage, which meant a 3-hour sit in Phoenix. And we took advantage of it. So what we're going to show you after this is we have a guest. It was impromptu. We didn't do any preparation, but we did our first guest interview on camera in the cabin of the airplane with Pat Lewis. And you'll get to hear Pat's story here in just a couple of minutes. And I think Pat, it's a good one.
Yeah. Well, I hope it is. I haven't seen any of it. I was just sitting there, you know, asking him questions and that, you know, which he's an interesting guy. He's, you know. He's actually done quite a bit. He's doing quite a bit. He does a lot of interesting, cool stuff, as you'll see here in a minute.
Yeah, Pat's one of our full timers. He has an administrative role within the company. He's also one of our pilots. He's PIC rated on the 73, the A320, and now the A330. And he has become a huge part of our operation. He's a young guy, in his mid 30s. And he's got a very different story, a very different path to becoming a ferry pilot. He's living the dream. And Pat was also a CFI for both of my sons. So we get into how Pat met us and what his experience is like. It's a good interview in just another couple of minutes. We'll do side shtick and then we'll go right into the interview with Pat. By the way, Pat's also a musician and we're going to close out the episode today with some of his music.
Yeah. Yeah, some cool stuff.
So without further ado, we're going to get into this week's side shtick, and I'm going to set an alarm. We're going to Everyone wants us to extend it to be longer, but I mean, we'll talk forever, man.
God, I know. We've already, you know, now we try to time ourselves and limit these segments, and it never works.
Well, here we go. It's going to be 10 minutes. The timer started. Today's side shtick is going to talk. We're going to talk about airport lounges. Okay.
Nice.
You know, most people think of an airport lounge as a luxury thing. Ah, fancy pants. Oh, you're in the lounge. You're not going to sit with Gen Pop. Some people who aren't used to, like, maybe long haul traveling, and they've never been to a lounge. They don't even know what it is. Like, maybe you have this vision in your head of, you know, this awesome, amazing experience.
Don't start going to them, or you'll hate the airport experience when you can't get into the lounge.
Yeah. Well, the reality is they can be a blessing. They can also be a curse. Some of them are great. We're going to talk about lounges in the U.S., lounges outside of the U.S. We're going to give our top three. First of all, you have airport lounges that are affiliated with the airlines. So each airline has its own brand of lounge. And then you have the credit card lounges. That's another tier of lounge. And then you have your independent lounges, and those you can usually access with the, what's the name of that card? Have it. It's the,
yeah, I don't know. I never use it.
I know. I should have prepared for this.
Yeah. I can't. Yeah. I don't know. There's some card that gets you in.
Yeah. There's a card that gets you into like all the different lounges and stuff. And it's like you pay an annual fee and then it opens up. Those lounges kind of suck. Okay. That's the reality is like those lounges are not great. They're like, they will segregate you from Gen Pop, but they won't provide you with a really good lounge experience.
Yeah. It's usually terrible food and.
Yeah. What constitutes a good lounge experience for you, Bob?
Well, number one, a relaxing atmosphere where you have enough room. There's lots of seating. You can sit down. It's quiet.
Not like a hard seat either, like soft, cushy seating.
Some of them even have like lounge chairs. I mean, so you can lounge there. They've got like great Wi-Fi. They've got like pods that you can go into and make phone calls. So you're not, you know, nobody else is hearing you talk about something. You're not interrupting others. And so you can just, you can go in there. It's quiet. It's stress-free. And you can get things done. You know, yeah. I can get on my computer and I can, you know, actually get some work done between flights or just relax. If, you know, if it's 3 or 4 hours, I could just take it easy. There's usually food in those lounges. The good ones have a good selection of food. They always have like tons of alcohol. Some of them have bars. Some of them have good champagne that you can go up and, you know, pour all you want, or wine. I don't drink when I travel. So that part of it does me no good. But a lot of people do, you know, certainly take advantage of that.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing that matters to me with lounges is space and a seat. I need space, and I need a place to sit my ass down where I can, like, I'm always like carrying shit. I'm sweating. I'm never in a good place when I'm at the airport, like about to travel. I'm rushing around.
Yeah, it's stressful.
It's stressful, right? So I want to like sit down. I want to put my AirPods in. I want to scroll social media. And so in my opinion, the more restrictive lounges are, the better. Because what's happened is like a lot of these lounges, especially in the United States, when you get into a lounge and you can't even find a place to sit, and there's like, it's loud, and there's like, you know what? I'm just going to start with the worst of the worst. Delta lounges in Atlanta. Forget about it. I would rather go into one of those smoking cubicles in Atlanta. I'm not even a smoker. Ugh. Okay. I'd rather breathe secondhand smoke for 45 minutes, you know, then sit in a lounge where stand, you know, A to B with somebody in a lounge and eat out cold cuts.
So before I'm going in the smoking lounge, Steve, I'm going to go into one of those breastfeeding cubicles that they have.
Have you been in a breastfeeding cubicle?
I have not been in it, but I've seriously thought about it from time to time, like late at night. You know, you're there, you're waiting, you know, your flight's delayed, or, you know, and it's no point in going to a hotel room. I'm like going, I wonder if I just go in that breastfeeding cubicle, if I could just like lock the door and lay down. I mean, who's, you know, Somebody going to be breastfeeding in the middle of the night, right? Like, but then I'm like, can you get arrested for that? Okay.
Probably.
I'm off on a whole nother tangent, but.
Yeah, well, that's what happens with side shtick. There's too many people. It's hot. It's stuffy. The food's not good. I mean, and Delta's Lounge in Detroit's good. But I've never had a problem there. It's always.
But let's talk about the reason why. And this is going to piss off a lot of frequent flyers, because, but they get lounge access because of the credit card, not because they fly a lot. We're the guys that are out flying all the time. All of our points come from actual sitting in the seats, flying, buying tickets. And we have to compete with space with the people that are, you know, don't fly that often, but, you know, put tens of thousands of dollars on their credit card a year.
Yeah. Restrictive is good. Best lounge system in America, hands down, United Polaris.
Yeah. United Polaris is great. Yeah, the Polaris Lounge. So they're like the higher, I mean, there's airline, there's United Airlines Lounge. There's the American Admirals Club. Those are the normal lounges where if you're flying a domestic flight, you can go in there and hang out.
But marginally then, better than Gen Pop.
Yeah. But the flagship lounge and the Polaris Lounge, respectively, are like a much higher level than those regular ones. I mean, they got good food. It's quiet. There's much fewer people in those.
Yeah.
So you can always find a place to seat. You're not fighting, you know, you're rolling around the place with your luggage, trying to find a place to sit.
I would argue United with the Polaris Lounge is almost too restrictive. Like Global Services, United Global Services is the equivalent of Concierge Key for United, you know, whereas Concierge Key is American. It's the invite only status. You know, if you fly a ton, spend a lot of money, you'll get UGS. Global Services can't even get into Polaris unless you're on a long haul international ticket. And that doesn't even mean if you're going to Colombia or, you know, that, you know, somewhere that's not Europe, Asia, Australia, you know.
I can't believe they don't let Global Services in the Polaris anytime. Yeah.
You're just allowed into the United clubs. United Polaris lounges at all the United hubs. That is what's up in the U.S. Shout out to them. I mean, it's a great product. It's a great place to kill time. I honestly got to say, United's my go-to carrier these days in the States.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah, me too.
None of the lounges in the United States are anywhere close to what's out there and what are the best lounges in the world. The best lounges in the world are the Middle East Airlines. And I would say my top two, Emirates First Class Lounge, best in the world, man. Just like their product. Best in the world. You have sushi. They have massage. They have like 10 different kinds of food. There's limitless places to sit. There's not that many people there. It's the bright part is bright. The dark part is dark. It's awesome. And then my number two, Turkish, the new Turkish lounge.
So I don't know. Have you experienced the Al Safwa First Class Lounge in Qatar?
Yeah.
Oh, that's my favorite. I think that is better than the Emirates First Class Lounge.
Really?
Oh, yeah. That first class lounge is unreal. I mean, they have a spa. It's like going into a museum that has a spa inside. I mean, they have a spa, like a gourmet restaurant. They have sleeping rooms, but it's, I mean, there's artwork and sculptures, and it's so quiet. It's amazing how quiet it is because it's like crazy chaos beyond the doors. It's so loud out there with everything going on.
But, oh my God. Actually, I forgot the most important thing in a lounge, Bob. The showers.
Yes, exactly. That is key right there.
Yeah.
You have to have showers. We use them extensively with all the travel. And that makes all the difference in the world when you're traveling. To be able to just like get off of a, you know, 20 hours of traveling and you got more traveling to do. To go in, take a shower, change your clothes, you feel like a million bucks afterwards.
Give me your top three lounges worldwide.
Al Safwa, First Class Qatar. Emirates First Class in Dubai. I love that Turkish lounge. That Turkish lounge might be second on my list just because it's got unbelievable amounts of different Turkish food available.
And food is like, I love so Turkish good. Food, man. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, yeah. Yeah. That's, it might even be my favorite just because of the food.
Yeah. It's there's so a golf good. Simulator there too, by the way.
Yeah. And a flying simulator. You can like, they got some weird thing. It feels like you got like wings on your back and you go flying around. It's,
I haven't done that.
Yeah. It's a different kind of experience. It's kind of cool.
I got to say.
Yeah.
Top three, same Emirates, Turkish, and then, I'll go Polaris, man. I'm happy with Polaris. Give them props. I'm going to give them top three status in the U.S.
Yeah. Yep. I agree. We're pretty much aligned on that one.
So that's it. All right, guys. So we're going to say goodbye. Now we're going to go to our interview with Pat Lewis. Enjoy the interview. And then we're going to close out the pod with Mass Fear, Pat's band.
Cool. Can't wait to hear it.
All right, we're coming at you live, not live,
actually. 41,000 feet.
In the back of an airplane. Nobody's flying.
We rented this airplane just for this podcast.
Yeah. Pat and I are actually going to fly this thing across the Pacific Ocean tonight. Bob's meeting us here in Phoenix, and we have a few hours to kill before we leave. And so, welcome to the pod.
Thanks, guys. to find myself here.
Ever think you'd be doing a podcast while sitting in the back of an airplane in the middle of the night?
No, I can't say that was on my list.
Do you have time to prepare for this interview?
No.
Good.
So I'll start. I mean, I've known Pat now for what, 3 years?
Yeah, I'd say about that.
Almost 3 years. Yeah. So Pat was my son Tyler's flight instructor when his senior year in high school, he got his private pilot's license. Pat happened to be the CFI that was assigned to Tyler. Pat was coming toward the end of his CFI career at that point, right? What was your job outlook at that point when we met?
It was actually pretty lucky that Tyler even wound up on my schedule because my schedule was insanely packed.
Yeah.
And I wasn't even taking new students. And you and Tyler went in and talked to the woman that ran the flight school.
Barb,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. And she thought that it would be a good fit based on what you guys were looking for. So he just popped up on my schedule one day and I was like, I don't even know. Who's this? Like, I have no idea who this is.
One thing I've always wondered, actually, is how did you get into flying? You know, I'm sure there's a lot of people that want to know kind of how you started and how you ended up where you're at now.
Well,
at least to that point, you know, where you got started being hired by the regionals.
Yeah. So, I mean, if we're going way back,
you weren't like a 22-year-old CFI. Like, how old are you now?
So I just turned 34.
Looks like he's 25, but he's 34.
With gray hair. Slowly turning into you.
it happened.
My dad was in the Air Force, but so when I was a little kid, he got me into aviation related stuff and like we would build models together and go to air shows and stuff like that. So I always really had an interest in it. He was in the Air Force. He didn't fly though, but he was just always really into it as well.
Yeah.
And so I just always had that interest. And then when I was in high school, like around the time most people start, you know, like toward the end of high school or right after high school, I was in a band that was kind of serious and like we went on some tours and stuff. And so that was just my main focus.
Like music tour. Like
yeah. Yeah.
We're in a music band.
Yeah. Like we did the East Coast a couple times out to the Mississippi.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Like a handful of like 2 to 3 week tours. Yeah.
And spoiler alert, Pat is still in a band. Yeah. And
old habits die hard.
Yeah. Of course. So he really does fit in around here in every way.
We all want to be rock stars.
Yeah.
Pat's a real one.
So you graduate from high school. And aviation is not like really in your sights.
It was still like in my free time at home and stuff. I'd be on a flight sim, but I wasn't thinking of it as a profession at that point. Although when I was younger, like that, it was 100% on my radar set. But just, you know, things happen, you know, and you start chasing other things. But
yeah.
So by the time I kind of stepped away from music for a while, I was like, man, I really wish I started flying, but due to just my own lack of research, I was kind of like, oh, that ship sailed.
Is this before college? Because you went to Alabama.
Yeah. Now, honestly, this would probably be after I dropped out, came back home. Because then I was kind of like, all right, I need to figure out what I want to do. Like I said, my own lack of research. So I thought, oh, well, if you want a career in flying, you either have to join the military or you have to go to like an Embry-Riddle or something like that. And I kind of had a sour taste in my mouth from college. So I was like, I'm not going to go back to a four-year university at this point. And I knew you could get like your private pilot at like your local airfield, but I didn't realize that you could go all the way through.
You didn't really know what the path was. Like you were in, you were interested in aviation. Yeah. It seemed insurmountable. Mm. You didn't really give it a whole lot of thought. And you were just like, yeah, I don't know. I missed that. I missed the bus.
Yeah, there wasn't anybody in your family that was like, you know, telling you what the pathway.
Yeah, exactly. Steps were. Yeah. So I basically just kind of like wrote it off, even though I still like had always loved it. My girlfriend, now wife, 1 year for Christmas bought me a Discovery flight and kind of drug my feet with it. And like, I think I finally followed through on it around like July. So this would have been 2017. So it would have been Christmas 2016, July 2017. I did the Discovery flight and it went really well. And, was, you know, CFI said, oh, yeah, you have a pretty good foundation. Like you should consider actually pursuing it if you really want to. I just remember on that Discovery flight, just while I was doing, you know, I was all tense, everything, because I'd never flown a plane before. But I just remember in my head just thinking, this feels right. Like, nothing feels like, oh, I don't, maybe I need to like do another one to see how I feel about it. It was just like, nope, this is it.
I want to do this.
Yeah. So then after that, I just immediately started looking into flight training. And
so like the huge obstacle for most people that want to do it is obviously finances, right? How did you cross that bridge?
So it was kind of scary and stressful because, so I remember I specifically talking with my mom, because I still lived at home at the time. And she said, well, how are you going to pay for it? And I said, I don't know, but I'll figure it out. So basically what I did was I made enough money not to pay for it outright. I could have, but it would have taken me so long to get through training if I was paying for it out of pocket. So I went over to my local bank and managed to take out a loan for, I think the first loan I took out was for $25,000.
Yeah.
And
you went up, you came up through like a Part 61 program?
Yeah, so I did all Part 61. Well, so initially, it's a long story, but the program I went to was supposed to be 141, and then they had all kinds of issues. So it wound up being like 61 when it was all said and done.
Yeah.
Was it at the same place that you took the Discovery flight? Flight training?
No, so I did my private pilot training out of Northeast Philly.
Okay.
Yeah. And then after that, I moved over to Flying W, which is then where I instructed.
Okay.
So private pilot was Northeast Philly, and then all the rest of my training and ratings were obtained at Flying W.
So what year did you start flying?
My first actual like legitimate lesson was October 21st, 2017. My commercial, so it's 2026. I got my commercial, I think, in May or June of 21.
Here's Tyler CFI. Tyler makes it through. You know, you fly with him quite a bit. I mean, he was in high school at the time.
So when did Tyler start? What year?
He was so that was in 23, yeah, I guess.
23.
Yeah. Okay. He was a senior in high school. We all knew that this was going to be the path for Tyler. Yeah. And you know, he didn't love regular school, like college, regular traditional college wasn't going to be a great fit for him. He's always been interested kind of in aviation and asking a lot of questions.
Like three people sitting here.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's literally been his life, right? I mean,
yeah,
as Mike, you know, right. You're on airplanes. You're always around airplanes. Yeah.
Same with my son did the same thing.
So he was a senior in high school, got his private. He trained like throughout the school year. I met you like pretty much right away, right?
I think it was like the second flight lesson because... So I probably told you this before, but if not, so I remember I was running a few minutes late that day. So I came like rushing in and Tyler was waiting in the area and you were sitting next to him and I didn't know who you were. And it's not uncommon for people to just hang out at the airport and talk to whoever's hanging around. So I had no idea you were his dad. So I just came up and I like didn't even acknowledge you. I just remembered it, Tyler. And then you're just like standing there and you're like, hey, I'm Steve. And I was like, hey. And you're like, I'm Tyler's dad. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm so sorry. Like, nice to meet you. And then, yeah, I knew nothing about Cockpit Casual or anything. And like Tyler even brought it up. He was like, you know, like Cockpit Casual.
So right off the bat, I didn't want to be like one of those guys. First of all, I didn't want to micromanage Tyler's training. Yeah. So I was a CFI for a long time as well, like a long time, like many, many years. I have, I don't know, probably close to 2,000 hours of dual given.
No, no kidding.
Yeah, a lot, man. I mean, because the industry was a disaster when I was coming up, right? So I was not going to micromanage. I was not going to dance mom, baseball dad. I wasn't going to do any of that.
You weren't riding along on their flights.
No, but I did.
Actually.
I did want Pat to like have an idea that kind of knew what I was talking about a little bit. Like I'd done this before and I feel like I made it pretty clear from the get go that what you say, you're the boss.
Yeah.
You know,
like, why hasn't my son soloed yet?
Yeah. Like, I'm not going to be that guy.
Well, and I also, so. You told me all about yourself and what you do and everything. So I was like, all right, this guy clearly knows what the process is and everything. But you also said, like, I'm not trying to step on toes or anything. But so I just figured, I think it's best for everyone. Like, I'll just keep you in the loop with everything, game plan and everything. So I just tried my best to just really keep you up to date on everything. And like,
but I actually signed Tyler off for his written.
It's funny, which... I don't know when you'll address this later for Ryan's fine, but I'm 99% sure because I remember I was doing a cross country with a student and we got to Cape May. I checked my phone and you were like, is it cool if I just sign Tyler off tonight? And I said, yeah, I'm almost positive I was with Dan.
No, really?
Cross country.
Yeah. Dan is now Tyler's or Ryan's instructor, my youngest son's instructor as he's working on his private. It's full circle, man. It's.
Dan was a former student of mine and now.
And he went through quick. He went right through everything. I took note pretty quickly that Pat had a lot of experience for a CFI. I said, hey, do you want to intern with us?
Yeah.
Like, do you want to intern for Nomadic, you know, while you're waiting for your class date at Frontier? And of course, Pat was like, yes, you know, right. I was like, we'll get you on an A320. I said, come do a ferry flight with us.
The very first one we flew to Tampa. And the Phillies were in the playoffs.
Right.
So we went to a bar that night and watched the Phillies game. And then in the morning, the flight was scrubbed.
Right.
And I flew home. And you and Wes like went off to Asia to get.
We went to Singapore to pick up a LATAM 76.
So my first trip, basically, you and I flew to Tampa to drink a couple beers and watch the Phillies playoff game.
I mean, it was fun.
Sounds like a normal trip to me.
Yeah, it was China. It was in China.
You didn't have a China visa. Guys,
yeah.
You didn't have a China visa.
Because I think you actually looked into it and there was some.
Yeah, it was like the visa was the issue. There was some reason you couldn't go on.
Some authority said no.
Yeah, so Wes and I went and flew the 76 and then we came back and then that trip was ready and then you came. So what was that first trip?
So we took an A320 out of Tampa all the way to Jakarta. Going east,
because there was no HF.
Right, so we went Tampa to Bangor, Maine, Bangor to Keflavik, Keflavik to Cairo. Had a 18-hour layover in Cairo where we went to the pyramids.
We went to the pyramids.
Got scammed out of some money.
Yeah, is that when Jim
was with us?
When with you?
And Steve climbed down in a tomb and felt like we were going to die down there.
I mean, that's a hell of a first trip.
Yeah.
After Cairo, we stopped somewhere else too.
Mumbai. Yeah.
Did you get any stick time along the way?
Yes.
Yeah, first leg.
He had the first leg. Okay. It was the only domestic leg.
And I remember I actually hit my ATP minimums like a week before we did that trip.
Yeah.
Doesn't make a difference because I didn't have it. But
right. That was your first time ever flying anything that wasn't a Cessna or Piper or Seneca or something like that.
Right.
And it worked out pretty well. If I remember correctly, you flew a visual approach into... was it Portsmouth or Bangor?
Bangor.
Greased it on. Did you like catch the bug? Like,
oh yeah. Before I got into aviation, like even when I was back doing music, I just always wanted to travel, see as much as I could and everything.
Yeah.
And so like after that first trip, it was like, wow, this is something I love with something I wanted to do. And just it's like, I can't even... It was hard to comprehend that I was even getting an opportunity to do it, even as an intern.
Yeah. Did you feel like you coming from that very structured CFI world, mm-hmm. And then coming into this very unstructured world, was it just also overwhelming that you didn't even think about that at the time, or was it something that you did notice?
I think because it felt like I was trying to drink from a fire hose, the whole time, even though like before the trip, you had given me the FCOMs for the 320 and everything.
That's right.
It was one of those things where when I sat in the cockpit for the first time, actually seeing it in person, like from what you read about or watch videos on, it did make a lot more sense. But at the same time, it was still just like kind of felt like I was hanging on, the edge of the seat.
Yeah.
But I do remember when I was actually like hands-on flying the plane.
It's a plane.
Yeah. Well, and that's, there was like a voice in the back of my head, like, it's a plane. Just fly it.
It's all the same, man. Yeah. It doesn't matter what's behind you. Like, behind that door is irrelevant. Like, it's still a plane.
And the reality of it is, it seems unstructured, but we're actually very structured when it comes to the cockpit and our procedures. It seems very disorganized in terms of, the actual getting to the airplane and the trips get delayed and all of that stuff. And it kind of is. It all does kind of happen haphazardly.
Yeah.
And then it all comes together. So we kind of live in that world. But when we kind of cross into the cockpit, it becomes a very disciplined world.
Yeah.
And so we're kind of like, always living between these two different worlds. So, you've adapted very well to that. And that's what I always wonder about, somebody that comes into this with low time. It's not like a very structured environment, like an airline job where you're trained to do this, this, and this. And then there's scheduled times to push back, scheduled times to be places. Mm-hmm. I think people have a view of what we do as kind of like a cowboy operation. Like, oh, this is just like jump in and go and all of this stuff. And it's really not. It is really very structured in a lot of ways and takes a lot of discipline to come from this kind of unstructured part of it and jump into the cockpit and put on a different face.
Kind of like flip a switch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I always thought that would be a difficult thing for, somebody like you that comes into this environment. But, you've adapted to it very well.
Well, this is also all he knows, to some degree.
Well, yeah, that's true. And, I don't know if you, learned that from us.
At the end of the day, what's most important in this, obviously flying skills is quite important. It's also very much about personality. Like, how do you perform under pressure, under stress? Like, how do you perform when the days are really long?
Right.
And, and Bob and I are grumpy.
Have I yelled at you yet?
No, I think I've been spared.
That's doing shocking. Right. I've already prepared my son to be yelled at by Bob.
Yeah. When I get in the cockpit, I do like things to go a certain way. And
he's never yelled at me.
No, I'm afraid of you. I think you beat me up in Nigeria one time.
That's another story. That's another story. Well, we were there for 2 weeks. We were wrestling. That's another story.
Yeah, with our shirts off.
Possibly.
Other trends.
So ultimately, Pat was just a good fit. And I was like, what if we send you down to get an A320 type and your ATP, like on our dime? And would you commit 6 months or a year or something like that? And you were like, yeah, hell yeah.
Absolutely. No brainer.
So we, shortly after you got your 320 type, we did a trip together and we brought my son Tyler along in the jump seat. That was a standard airworthiness certificate, Airbus factory delivery. And it was an opportunity that we could actually bring somebody along. That was cool. Cause I remember that's the struts.
That's the fuel settling.
Yeah. So these, we just put 30, almost 40,000 kilos of fuel on this thing.
Yeah.
And so the struts just, every now and then it just drops down. It feels like someone drove a truck into the airplane.
Earthquake.
It'll get your attention.
Yeah. Has every time.
So we went out to Toulouse. We went to the Aerospace Museum there at Toulouse. That was a memorable thing, man. But I remember walking in the airplane and Pat's got Tyler in the left seat. Pat's in the right seat and Pat's teaching him how to program the MCU.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. So yeah. I mean, that is something that you've seen that like, very few people see. I mean, you get in these airplanes, we don't have databases mm-hmm. in them sometimes. Sometimes they're not current databases, and we actually have to build waypoints, build airports. And yeah, that's something that you've done many, many times. You could probably do it in your sleep now.
My fingers hurt.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is one thing that I definitely want to touch on before we wrap it up, and that is everyone's always talking about how do you guys switch between types so often? And 24,000 hours ish. You're over 30,000 now, you know, and we've been doing this for a long time. And it's like, I don't know how we do it. We just do it. You get used to it. And
it's second nature to us.
So at Pat's first A320 anniversary, when it was time for him to do his recurrent, instead of doing recurrent on the 320, we sent him to 737 school. That was last year. You have a PIC type rating on the 320, the 737, and you just did the 330 CCQ last month. And, I'll ask, you can talk about it. The 320 and the 330 are very similar. Mm. What did you think going into flying multiple types? Like, how did you mentally prepare for that when you went to 737 training? And how has it been your first full year flying two different manufacturers?
Right. So I'd say in the build up to it, I definitely felt a little nervous and stressed because, it's a whole different aircraft, different manufacturer, so different systems and everything.
Different call-outs, different methodologies.
Yeah. So, yeah, lots of stuff in terms of, like, memory items, stuff like that. Yeah, like logic or theory. After going through it, honestly, the aircraft are way more complex, but I feel like you can almost compare it to being a CFI and hopping in and out of a bunch of different aircraft. Because by the time I was done CFIing, I was at a point where I was hopping in and out of 172s, 182s, Pipers, Bonanzas, all different kinds of aircraft. And I felt totally comfortable with any of them at that point. But I remember, if you go back far enough, I only flew Pipers. And the first time I hopped in a Cessna, I was like, oh,
yeah,
this is different.
Yeah.
And now it's just exactly. And the systems, maybe they're oriented a little differently. It might look a little different on the panel, but at the end of the day, they all operate the same way.
Now the 320 and the 330, pretty easy transition, wouldn't you say?
Very easy, honestly. It's actually surprising. There are differences, but you think just in the sheer size difference, you think there'd be a way bigger difference than there really is. But it just feels like a wider 320 cockpit.
From an operator perspective, the 320 and the 330 and 340, they're the same thing. I mean, like, the job up front is the same. And systems knowledge is a little different. I actually find the wide body is a little easier. The next step is going to be putting in the left seat and having you actually operate as PIC. I've been putting you in the left seat the last few trips on the 7.3 and on the 320. It's the management of the trip that takes the time.
Exactly. Yeah. The trip management and the decisions that you make, you came in here with a lot of skills and, like, in your admin role and, it's kind of seeing the business side of what we do, you've been involved with a family business.
Right.
And so, I can see that, you've got some business sense to you too. So there's a lot of factors that brought you in, and you were capable of doing what you do.
So Pat is also a musician, plays the guitar, records as a band. And we're going to close out the episode with a track that Pat chooses. Maybe we'll do the video. You have a video, right?
Couple of videos. Yeah.
Should we do a video? Yeah, we'll let you pick.
Okay.
We'll close out the episode with a musical select. It's like a metal band. It's pretty.
Metal light. What the genre?
Yeah.
So there's so many subgenres, but it would be like metalcore, post-hardcore, probably more post-hardcore.
You do the songwriting?
Yeah, I write all the instrumentals. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And then they have the singer writes the vocals. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, and I help here and there, but it's mainly him.
Yeah. They've got tons of downloads on Spotify too. Like,
it's
down like tens of thousands.
What's the name?
So the band is Mass Fear. We're on all socials and everything. If you like a little heavier music, check it out.
Mass Fear Band.
Yeah.
Well,
and I don't know what song I'll pick yet, but they'll find out.
All right. You'll hear.
It's great having you here, Pat. I always enjoy flying with you.
Thanks, guys.
And you're the first interview.
Yes.
So we're cutting our interviewing teeth.
Going in the Hall of Fame.
with a familiar face, so.
On an unfamiliar airplane.
Yes.